Good evening. Welcome to Wednesday Night Live. Hope you're doing well. Voice is returning to normal. 16th of April, 2025. And we are on the Wednesday Night Live. I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume the audio and video going well. Testing. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. Just going to double check, and that looks good. All right. So I wanted to, we'll do your questions and comments, of course, as always. But Toby Rogers, The Political Economy of Autism, is something that was posted. This is it's kind of out of date. It's 2019, so it's 6 years ago. But the numbers kind of blew my mind. It blew my mind. Again, this is old, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just did a whole press conference today saying that they're weeks away from, I think, getting the kinds of data that is going to point the way towards the cause of the astonishing increases in autism over the past, say, half century. And he says he's convinced it's environmental. Who knows what that means? I think most of us have some idea what that means or what might mean, but I just think it's absolutely astounding. So that's, again, this is 2019. The numbers blew my mind, and of course they're worse now. So he wrote, autism is a global epidemic. An estimated 1 in 40 children in Australia, 1 in 64 children in the UK, and 1 in 36 children in the US have an autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. This is an enormous increase from the first known autism prevalence study in the U.S. in 1970 that established an autism prevalence of less than 1 per 10,000. Several studies have shown that changes in diagnostic criteria account for only a small fraction of the increased prevalence. And I think Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did reference that they went back and retested everyone from an old study and found that they'd only missed one kid. Sorry, that's not the most detailed summary of a scientific study, but so this, I knew these numbers in general, but he goes on to write, families of children on the spectrum face extraordinary additional expenses and decreased earnings as one parent often becomes a caregiver. Autism costs the U.S. $268 billion, 1.5% of GDP in 2015. If autism continues to increase at its current rate, autism will cost the U.S. over $1 trillion, or 3.6% of GDP in 2025. As a point of comparison, he says U.S. Defense Department spending is 3.1% of GDP. Wow. That is wild. He goes on to write, over the last decade, several groups of leading epidemiologists, doctors, and public health experts have published consensus statements declaring that toxicants in the environment are contributing to the rising prevalence of neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism. Beyond the consensus statements, a range of independent researchers have identified many additional factors that appear to increase autism risk. Given rising prevalence rates and the extraordinary impacts of ASD on individuals, families, and communities, what explains why public health authorities thus far have failed to ban or restrict toxicants that may have been shown to increase autism risk? He says, I argue that autism is not only a public health issue, it also represents a crisis of political economy. In this thesis, I will show that capitalism has transformed science and medicine from a focus on use values to a focus on exchange values. Regulation is largely a reflection of political power, not scientific evidence. And cultural and financial capture are blocking the sorts of regulatory responses that are necessary to stop the autism epidemic. And if you want to look for this, I found it on X. It's called The Political Economy of Autism by Toby Rogers. It's well worth reading. It's obviously, you can imagine, chock full of acronyms, but well worth reading. And let me just, I'm going to ask this as a whole. Oh dear. I seem to have lost my, what do you just have to cycle through all the tabs to get the icons back, right? Control tab, control tab. Swirly, swirly, swirly. And here we go. Because I'm curious. I mean, this was all the data as of 2019. And where is it at now? It's got to be even wilder. Yeah, okay. Let's grok it. When I hear that rock and roll. All right. What percent of U.S. GDP is autism costs? That's not the most elegant way to put it. Ah, it's 2015. Oh, so his 2025 projections, 461 billion, range 276 to over a trillion. Yeah. Okay, so he took the very high end of that. It looks like the study that said costs could reach a little over a trillion, or 3.6, has been retracted. So it's just important. So given the 2025 projection of 461 billion and an estimated GDP of 25 trillion, autism costs likely represent 1.8 to 2% of US GDP. Wow. That's jaw-dropping to me. And of course, that is just the financial costs. The emotional costs are absolutely wild. So let's get to your comments and questions. Somebody says, I wonder if some part of the rise in autism is the result of the shift in the priorities of education in civilizations with large amounts of specialized labor. I don't think that would be it. I mean, if mothers and fathers are older now, maybe that has an effect. There are could be environmental toxins. I know the vaccines are in the targets for a lot of people. So it's some wild, wild numbers, though. And do you know a family with somebody who has autism? Do you know a family with somebody who has a child, or I guess it could be anyone who has autism? Or it's a spectrum, right? I get this is a spectrum, but I'm just curious whether you know people like that. A carnivore Aurelius wrote, modern psychiatry would be like, oh, you can't sit down in class? Okay, here's meth. And Peter McCullough, the obviously very brave Peter McCullough, wrote just yesterday, autism prevalence in the U.S. kids jumps 16.1% in just 2 years. New CDC data reveals 1 in 31, 3.22% of Americans 8-year-olds were autistic in 2022, a staggering 384% increase since 2000. Now, I get that there's financial incentives and money involved, and I get all of that. But holy crap. Whew. Chuck Calest wrote, and this is just today, 1 in 9 children now diagnosed with ADHD. Oh, the medication generation. The medication generation. Oh, yeah, so the Vigilant Fox wrote, RFK Jr. just completely dismantled the better diagnosis excuse used to downplay the autism epidemic, and he brought the receipts. Kennedy cited a peer-reviewed 1987 study from North Dakota that set out to find every child in the state with a developmental disorder. Researchers combed through medical records, verified diagnoses, and conducted in-person evaluations across a population of 180,000 children. Then they followed that same group for 12 years. If you still believe autism rates are only rising because of improved diagnosis, Kennedy said, you'd have to believe those researchers somehow overlooked 98.8% of autistic children. But they didn't. They went back to 2000 and found that they had missed exactly one child. They weren't missing all these cases, he said. The epidemic is real. Wild. Somebody says, I do not know anyone in personal life, but troubled families are looking for any diagnosis to get their children medicated and compliant. I think there's some truth in that for sure. Just jump topics a little bit. Murray Hill guy wrote, a 7.5 guy versus a 5.5 girl experience on dating apps. 7.5 guy, two likes this week, one was a bot. One, the other unmatched after, hey, got told he's too nice. Thought he had a connection. She said, sorry, not feeling a connection, but best of luck. 5.5 girl, 143 likes in 24 hours, as opposed to two likes this week for the guy, wrote, let's find the best espresso martini, and got 50 or more date offers. One guy offered to fly her to Miami just for the weekend. Another had courtside Knicks tickets and said, pick the game. Her ex wants her back and offered to pay her rent. Isn't that wild? Bitcoin Teddy wrote, 80% of all dollars were created in the last 5 years. Have a good night. 80%. Mm. Starter home prices have risen by 87% over the past 7 years, from 156,000 in 2017 to 292,000 and change in 2024. Oof. All right, let's get to your questions and comments. Somebody says, I was a high school teacher and I felt a lot of students were claiming autism just to have an excuse to shield themselves from responsibility and social interaction. Perhaps some of the faux claims undermine the real cases. I don't know. Yeah, only 15% of women show interest in 5'8 men on dating apps, according to a survey. Yeah. Well, women can afford to be picky because they have the state as their backup, right? Somebody says, my friend's dad has Asperger's, apparently, although he is an engineer. Fair point. Kayla says, I have a friend with an 8-year-old that has her medicated. Says in the mornings, the 8-year-old just yells and screams at her until her meds kick in and she calms down. She's learning at a grade 1 level. Mom chooses not to stay home because work is her escape from home life. Husband works out of town for weeks at a time. Yeah. The did you know that since since October the 31st, 2000, there has always been at least one human being in space at all times. I like this joke. Do you think I reference dinosaurs too much when I write? I asked. She was silent, like the pea in pterodactyl, but it said everything. That's good. In boomer rage data, what do we have here? I saw a video the other night from a boomer talking about working at a plant with no degree at 24 years old. He earned $18 an hour in 1980. His mortgage was $193 a month. To achieve that ratio now, you'd have to earn about $198 per hour at a plant and no college bullshit. These I thought were cute. The laws of the internet from World of Engineering. 1. The Streisand effect. Any attempt to censor info on the web will lead to said info being widely spread. Muffrey's law. If you leave a comment correcting someone, there will always be a mistake in it. Cunningham's law. The best way to get an answer to a question is to answer it wrongly yourself and wait for someone to correct you. Armstrong's law. The longer a conversation goes without mention of America, the more likely an American is to arbitrarily bring up the moon landing. CAD's theory of topic culture. A smart post is less likely to receive a reply than a stupid post because it leaves less to be said, but a really full and comprehensive post will bring the conversation to a halt. Wadsworth content. The first 30% of any video contains no worthwhile information. I'm not saying that's entirely right. Have you seen this? I'm obviously not an expert in this, but it's pretty wild to see the blowback that's coming out of China for these tariffs. I don't know if you've seen these videos. It's wild. You never know what's coming in out of left field or right field. So what's wild is I think that a lot of the Chinese manufacturers have contracts that say you can't talk about who you're manufacturing for. Like if you're manufacturing for Hermes or something like that, you can't say who you're manufacturing for. And I think the government has liberated them, quote, liberated them from these contracts. And so now you've got all of these Chinese manufacturers who are out there and they're saying, here's how much it costs us to manufacture. It costs us $300. And then you buy it for $10,000. Like, look at this markup. It's crazy. And, you know, I did not have that in my tariff bingo card that the Chinese manufacturers were going to end up toasting the reputation of the high-end manufacturers or high-end retailers in America. And you can see just endless amounts of these videos with, I think, quite a significant amount of glee. Adam wrote, the world is about to realize that Louis Vuitton, Gucci, and Dior are just rebranded Shenzhen factory products. The luxury illusion is about to collapse. What a time to be alive. It's true. Somebody else wrote, neat world order. When you add up all the hours, boomers have spent something like 9 years of their lives in front of the television. If you think you can reason with such an entity, you're gravely mistaken. Clint Russell wrote, he's at Liberty Lockpot. He wrote, going to school in the 90s, I witnessed the first generation of young boys receiving a mass diagnosis of ADHD. I watched his friend after friend, all good kids, got hooked on this low-dose cocaine like Ritalin or Adderall. By high school, most were depressed. Then came the SSRI wave. By college, many turned to booze or hard drugs. A few went down the OxyContin path. Some never made it out. Most of those who survived are still on SSRIs or anxiety meds to this day. They got strapped to the pharma conveyor belt in elementary school. I'll never forgive the doctors who effed these kids up. It's stories like these that led to MAHA and Make America Healthy Again. We all have our own. Wild. Corporations, this is from the Bitcoin historian, Pete Rizzo. Corporations bought over 95,000 Bitcoin in Q1, the most of any quarter ever. Nice. Very nice. Congressman Kurt Weldon was on Tucker Carlson. I don't know him, his credibility, whatever, but this is something that I've heard about before, that Muammar Gaddafi was planning to launch a gold-backed currency to unite Africa. And that's one of the reasons why he was taken out in such a brutal, brutal fashion. All right. Happy to take your questions and comments, of course, freedomain.com/donate. To help out the show, it would be gratefully appreciated. Thank you, Durbins. You can, of course, tip on the Rumble and Locals apps as well, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. So somebody wrote, I went out with a girl a few days ago, and she said she has a huge problem with daycare and thinks childhood neglect lowers intelligence. We even spoke about breastfeeding, lowering IQ on our first date. It was refreshing. Oh, that's good to hear, but I think you mean breastfeeding, raising IQ. Yeah, $193 a month. Yeah, it's back in the day, man. Back in the day. I remember when I first came to Canada in 1977. candy bar was a dime. 10 cents. All right. Government spent $1.3 trillion in the past 6 months. How can Doge compete with that? Yeah. Well, it's pretty tough to play whack-a-mole with government spending, right? I mean, the best way to lower spending is to cut off things from the source. But that's pretty tough. Here's another little interesting fact. After all the employees go home, tall office buildings get just a little taller. A 1,300-foot tall skyscraper shrinks about 1.5 millimeters under the weight of 50,000 occupants, assuming they weigh about the human average. Isn't that wild? Little things I'd never really thought of. And there was a post that said, did you know you should always wash your bread before you eat it? I'm like, I'm afraid that's a hard no. Daddy likes it. Crunchy. All right, see your questions, comments. Yeah, I don't know how people just drug kids for these descriptive-based behavioral disorders. I mean, the drugs are real, but the disorders are just descriptions. It's not a good, there's no blood test for this stuff as a whole, right? This was so good. John Carter wrote this. He wrote, the COVID lockdowns dipped our social bonds in acid. I've moved around a lot throughout my life, he writes, and I found that I keep very few friends. I never had a problem making friends. It was just a matter of meet a couple of good guys and plug into their friend network. Worked the same everywhere. But once you leave, you lose touch because friendships won't. Any sort of human relationship require regular interaction to maintain. So once you leave, you lose touch, except maybe with a very small fraction of guys you become extremely tight with. By and large, though, you drift apart, and that's natural. Whenever I've returned to the same locale after long enough, the friend group I left behind has dissolved. People move away, they get in fights, they start hanging out with other friends. Again, that's fine. Human sociability is a fluid thing, it's a flow. As long as the flow continues, there's no problem. You just need to jump in. COVID, he wrote, as a really, really well written and very passionate. COVID, he wrote, stopped the flow. People were held apart long enough that their social bonds dissolved, just as though they'd all been sent to live on the other side of the world. Then they were bombarded with relentless, brain-melting propaganda. The ones who succumbed were driven mad. The ones who didn't succumb went down, do your own research, rabbit holes, and also, by and large, went mad, he writes. And everyone was forcibly hooked on screens. You know those addiction studies where you put rats in cages and let them have all the heroin they want? Turns out it's a combination of cage and heroin that's addictive. The rat is bored, it has nothing to do, and it is lonely. But here, this morphine-laced water will make it all go away for a while. That was done to every single one of us. We were turned into screen junkies. I'm swiping this on my screen now instead of talking to people. Sound familiar? We went from a world with an active social flow, dysfunctional as it was, and let's face it, it was the effing Ganges of social rivers. At least it was there. At least we were sort of connected to the people in our physical presence. Then we crossed the river Styx and emerged into a world of shades. Lonely, crazy people who can't talk to one another, even if they wanted to, which they largely don't because they no longer have anything in common with all these strangers surrounding them, except for the screens and the loneliness. The lethe waters were poured down our throats, whether we wanted to drink them or not. The old world, the human world, faded from our memories like morning mist. And now we wander a gray and barren waste, unrecognized and unrecognizing, searching for something we no longer even really know how to articulate. I mean, a bit strong, of course, and but yeah, very well written. Hey, Steph, could you briefly share your thoughts on The Substance movie and why it sucks ass? I think it sucks because it has little dialogue and runs like a cheesy music video. Also that it uses nauseating fisheye lens close-up shots, like the one of the guy eating shrimp. He's the gross bad guy, isn't he? Haven't we made it obvious enough that he's the gross bad guy? Yeah, that is it's the horror of the flesh. It's the horror of hedonism. It's the horror of chasing nerve endings and dopamine rather than virtue and love. And everyone said Dumont was great. She just frozen faced, I guess, a little bit irregularly that way. So, but yeah, it was. It's the horror of living for the flesh, which is seductive to the young and destructive to the aged. Somebody says, I'm a regular at a hipster cafe. Should I be honest with the barista and tell him what I really think or avoid talking about big issues? Or should I avoid being a regular at a hipster cafe? I mean, I think in general, be honest with your thoughts and feelings with people as a whole. But, you know, obviously be prepared for blowback. But all right. Gag Easter says, hi, Steph. I hope all is well. I just experienced one of the most heartbreaking things in my life. Sorry to hear that. I'm really close with my younger cousin. He is 18-year-old male and I'm a 25-year-old female. He was drunk for the first time and had a really aggressive flip where he was saying really nasty stuff to his dad and people were holding him so he wouldn't hurt him. He was never aggressive like that in front of me. When I tried stepping up, he called me a whore, tried to hurt me, but people were holding him. What do you think I should do? Oof, I'm sorry to hear that. That's a very tough situation. So, of course, alcohol is a disinhibitor. The Latin in vino veritas. In wine, there is truth. In wine, there is truth. So I imagine that he has had some big, difficult, ugly, nasty, significant issues with his father, and they've been bottled up in this wall of denial and avoidance. And what has happened is the alcohol has dissolved some of the ego barriers between the trauma and the expression. So if you bottle up aggression for too long, it's going to come out in random and often destructive ways. So I would say I assume he's calmer now, right? The alcohol has passed. So what I would do if I were in your shoes, and again, I'm really sorry for the situation. What I would do if I were in your shoes is I would sit down with him and say, tell me what was going on for you. I mean, I'm sure you remember some of it. I don't know how drunk he was. Oh, he was drunk, so he didn't just have a couple of drinks. He was drunk. So, yeah, what do you think was going on? Where was that coming from? What do you think? Tell me about the thoughts behind the words. Or even deeper, tell me about the memories behind the feelings, behind the thoughts, behind the words. Relentless curiosity is one of the most powerful things in the world. Just relentless curiosity. Just keep asking. Just keep asking. I mean, and don't take offense. I mean, I'm sure you don't need to have me say that to you, but, you know, I mean, he called you a whore. It's a terrible thing to say. He was drunk. And we can forgive people what they say when they're first drunk, because he didn't know this was going to happen. He didn't know this was going to be his experience. And so I think forgiveness is important. Don't take it personally. It's something talking that's not his kind of conscious mind, if that makes sense. And just keep asking. Keep asking what was going on for him, what he was thinking. Get back into politics, Steph. I don't think I will. I appreciate the feedback. Let's see here. Yeah, just ask a bunch of questions. and do your very best to just be open-hearted, open-minded, and not judgmental. All right, somebody says, I was at a friend's house who has three kids, all under 4 years old. The youngest child, roughly 14 months, she cannot talk yet, but can communicate. When she doesn't get her way, she will lay down on the floor and cry in obvious protest. I notice she's also very demanding at dinner. I'm not blaming her at all for the behavior because I think she's just doing what is most effective to get what she wants. It was strange to me because my daughter never did that and my friend doesn't believe me. Any advice? Yeah. Yeah. Children, people think that children escalate until they get what they want. I don't think that's true, at least not in my experience. And I've had a lot of experience with kids. As you probably remember, I worked in a daycare for many years as a teenager. Children and most people, they don't escalate until they get what they want. They escalate until they feel heard. The difference is really important. This is why listening is so powerful. If people feel heard, they mind a lot less being told no. If people are told no without feeling heard, they escalate in general. So people think that, oh, well, if I listen to my kid wants a cookie, right? If I listen to my kid, I got to give her a cookie. So they don't even listen. And then the kid escalates. So, having a tantrum or something. But if your kid wants a cookie, you can absolutely listen to that. You can absolutely sympathize with your kid wanting a cookie. And you can say, no cookie. If the kid is heard and understood, it deflates the escalation. I mean, this isn't true for everyone at all times, obviously, but with kids in particular, if they feel heard, they tend to de-escalate. Jared says, true for people calling into customer service line, being heard is worth three solutions. Yeah. That's a great point. Feeling heard is lacking. How would you show a 14-month-old that she was heard? Well, you'll have to give me the scenario of what she's complaining about. But I mean, obviously comfort is key. If you comfort the child, then you're showing that the child's upset means something to you. You know, I mean, I've mentioned this before, and I think I wrote about this in Peaceful Parenting, peacefulparenting.com. Please share the book. But when my daughter would be in the store, you know, they put all of this evil, bright, fruit-colored candy at eye level for kids, right? And my daughter would be like, I want the candy. And I'd be like, yeah, it looks great, doesn't it? I want the candy too. I could scoop that whole thing up. I could eat the whole thing. I would even eat the wrappers. I wouldn't even care. I would just pass those through. And so I empathized and sympathized. I said, yeah, I mean, I have to say no to candy. I like it too much. I have to say no to candy. And so you're modeling. You understand that they want the candy. You understand that it's attractive, that it's appealing, that you're drooling even thinking about it. So when kids want something, you can empathize with them wanting it. Yeah. Whereas people think, and the kid says, I want candy. And the parents then say, well, you can't have the candy. But the kid's saying, I want the candy, not give me the candy. Now, if the kid's saying, I want candy, you can say, I completely understand. I want candy too. I want candy. Bum, ba-dum, 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 bum. All right. So yeah, empathize with the feelings so that the kid feels understood and heard, and de-escalation is almost always the result. So he says, when I was over, she was pointing and demanding stuff to hold, just various things. The parents were just refusing. Yeah. So particularly with toddlers, you just have to multitask. So if she's pointing at something on the shelf, you're chatting away as the parent, you go get the thing from the shelf and you give it to the kid. Right? There's no reason to say no. I mean, you say yes as much as possible to your kids. Wouldn't you? I mean, you say yes as much as possible to your wife. You say yes as much as possible to your boss. You say yes as much as possible. I mean, how many questions do I not answer? Like 1% of questions I don't answer. So with your kids, you say yes as much as possible. Jimmy says, hey, we have elections coming up here in Australia. Do you personally think financially supporting a political party is a good way to spend your money? Thanks. I mean, I really can't answer that. I'm a Bitcoin guy. I can't answer what is of value to you. What would be your response if someone looks really sad when they're talking to you? Would you not mention it? Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of distracting if you don't, right? If somebody's like really, you know, sad and hollow-eyed, and then it'd be kind of distracting and dissociating to not notice that. Say, well, just, you know, pause for a second. You seem to be kind of down. Something you want to talk about or anything that I can do to help? But yeah, you should mention it. It's a cry for help or a cry for recognition or a plea for understanding or curiosity or something like that. All right. What did I miss? Oh, yes. Freedomain.com/donate. Somebody says, I recently rewatched Blue Velvet, since you had mentioned the opening scene. As you may know, from the 70s onward, Lynch lived in Los Angeles. Do you think some of his portrayal of American society in this movie is informed by his life in Hollywood? Incidentally, I was horrified to find he had a relationship with the lead actress. Yes. David Lynch, you know, dove into the dregs. He went straight to the dregs, to the biting insects underneath the grass. And I talk about this more in the French Revolution. Like, you leave the wounded behind in society. You leave the wounded behind at your very great peril. Very, very, very great peril. There's almost no spirit more spiteful, aggressive, and sometimes hateful than the spirit left behind on a broken refuse of childhood while society marches ahead in joy and glee. The urge to backstrike is almost overwhelming. And the equation, and we saw this played out in the French Revolution, other revolutions as well. The playbook is something like this. If you leave me behind, you're worthless to me. You mean nothing to me. If you leave me behind. If society moves ahead and leaves the victims of child abuse behind or blames them for their own dysfunctions. If society marches on and leaves the broken behind, the broken will break back. It will break society back. A lot of vengeance in that. All right. Tim Pool posted about a successful PhD woman who traveled the world, says she's missing something from her life. Family, you're missing your family. Billions of years of evolution, and one day feminists just decided we can live without family. So this woman wrote, let me just zoom this up a little. Apparently I can't zoom. All right. Something is missing from my adult life. I don't know what it is. 31-year-old female. So I did the crazy things. I worked my ass off through 12 years of education and training through my PhD. I've traveled to like 30 plus countries, have a few close-ish friends, a 15-year monogamous relationship with a man that makes me laugh every day. I've pulled myself out of poverty and feel like I've accomplished a lot of my initial goals. The others will take time. I have a good paying but stressful job that takes up most of my time. Most days I get up at about 5 a.m., come home at about 7:30 or 8 p.m., make dinner, go to bed. On the weekends, I don't really know what to do besides groceries, chores, and meal prep. It just feels like something is missing. I'm bored, despite how hectic my life is. I don't have time or resources to start a family. I make good money, but not enough to pay for childcare 12 hours a day. I don't live in an area with any sense of community. With my schedule, there are no classes or activities I can join in my area. I'm not religious, so I suppose there isn't a spiritual aspect of my life either. Is this really what adulthood is? Just working and coming home until you can afford to retire? I just keep trying to get back into the things I used to enjoy, but I just feel so uninterested and apathetic. Video games aren't doing it. I can't get into new books. I'm increasingly distancing myself from doom scrolling and social media. I'm not permitted to take vacations at my job, so anything but work-specific travel is off the table. I'm an American scientist. So life is quite stressful right now from multiple angles, but it feels like this has been going on for at least a year. I just don't know what else to do or look forward to. It's a very unsettling, hollow feeling. I needed my fix. Buy Steph's books. freedomain.com/books. I mean, they're mostly free, but I appreciate that. Become an American, Steph. Well, let's see. I'll just check and see if the $5 million for Trump's gold card has been deposited. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah, what's it? The great line from Shadowlands with Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger, where Anthony Hopkins plays a C.S. Lewis, I think. And did you get a sense of futility, sense of waste? Of course, right? The academics, the old academics, just feel pointless. I'll tell you that. I've experienced a lot of things in my life. A very interesting and rich life. I have experienced a lot of things in my life, but I have not experienced that kind of emptiness. At least not that I can recall. I'm sure occasionally, but nothing that I can really recall. Do you guys have that? What this woman is talking about, the sense of repetition, waste, emptiness. I mean, I think if you're a scientist and you forego having children because you're going to work on some, you know, big advancement, but if it's just a bunch of make work government normie slop, I don't know. I think it's pretty hard. I think deep down people process whether they're adding virtue and goodness to the world or not. And if you're not adding goodness to the world in some manner, I think you're just going to do a slow burn into inconsequentiality in your mind. We're here to do good. It's the one thing that we can do that no other creature can do is good. It's the one thing. One thing. Do you think this is true? This is from Amy Therese. She wrote, I believed for a long time that most people shy of psychopaths could be reasoned with, but many ordinary people can't. The things they say in conversation aren't their own considered responses to the queries of their interlocutor. Sorry. Often they are a pastiche of other people's half-masticated thought. They don't really understand. They just chew them up, swallow, and regurgitate them on call, like Pavlov's dog when something similar is discussed. Well, that's Ayn Rand's second-handers, right? Social metaphysicians. There's a big debate that's going on. It comes out of the Douglas Murray and Dave Smith debate. And just war theory, I've been quite fascinated with for many years. It's a very sort of I mean, in this sort of status concept, it would still apply in a free society, in a voluntary society. But I do find just war theory very interesting. Yeah, bombinthebrain.com. Thanks, Karis. Yeah, bombinthebrain.com. It's very important. All right, so let me just get to your questions. I have wide, anxious eyes when talking to people often. Do you think allowing myself to feel more emotion when talking to people will help prevent that? Oh, like Kash Patel has that sort of slight deer in the headlights look when talking to people. I had that too. I think my pupils were, my eyes would dilate. I would see that when I was up giving speeches, that I just, a little steery. But I have wide, anxious eyes when talking to people. So, but you do that as a mark of submission, right? If you're talking to people and your shoulders are up and, right, you're doing that as a mark of submission. So you should probably stop signaling submission to people. And just, you know, you don't have to narrow your eyes and use tough guy voice, but I would say calm down the startled deer response. And people who are physically relaxed signal equality, right? People who are tense signal either dominance or submission, right? But people who are physically relaxed, you're signaling a comfort level and a win-win negotiation situation. So as far as, you know, I'm a big fan of body work, not the store. I'm a big fan of body work. When I was in theater school, I did the Alexandra technique. I did, I've done yoga, aromatherapy, Tai Chi, all kinds of things. It's especially, you know, we who are in this kind of conversation, we do a lot of head stuff, right? A lot of thinking, a lot of abstraction, fly the pterodactyls of concepts to the far windy platonic reaches of ultimate ideals. And it's really important to ground your mind back in the body, to connect with the gut, you know, the gut instincts. To ground your mind back in the body is really, really important. So saunas, even things like that can be really, really good. So I'm a big fan of body work. Get your massages done and do some yoga. And the Alexandra technique was, for me, was very good for posture. The guy could tell I was beaten as a child. Like the moment he saw me, he's like, oh, your head's forward, your shoulders are up. You're beaten as a child. I'm like, get out of my head. somebody says, I can see what she means. It feels a bit like stagnation to me. Yeah. Groundhog Day sometimes. Yeah, that can certainly happen. Though, I mean, and I mean, enormously, deeply and humbly grateful to you guys for all of this, that I get to do such different work on a continual basis. I mean, I've loved doing the Bible work, the Bible analyses. I've really loved doing that. And I still get to do these great call-ins, freedomain.com/call. If you'd like a call-in, you're certainly welcome to send in your messages. Curse you, Skype. but Alain says, I decided to start going to church when I felt that way. It has really helped me interact with people with a positive and secure mindset, even though I'm still a very rational person. I'm glad it helped. Excuse me. Thank you for the tips. I appreciate that. Somebody says, church has had the opposite effect in my life. I found just control mechanisms at play. Join in with the crowd or feel ostracized. If you challenge the power, you will be condemned. Totally agree, Steph. You always seem to be moving around out in nature and staying in the moment with your daughter, etc. James says, we put out a call for donors today. I want to be an artist. Yeah, that was a good call-in. It's a good call-in. We got some. Yeah. Somebody says, the Bible series is great. I get a lot of catching up to do, but the episodes I've seen so far were very insightful. Thank you. So body work is like yoga. What about being still as a statue during conversations? Is that body work? You're talking like this in the middle of a conversation? I don't know. Ventriloquism is more of an act than a conversational art. Yeah, a church is the people. Church is, you will find a good church for yourself, I'm sure. So happy to take more questions. Hit me with a why if you're interested in the just war theory. What is just war? What are the rules of war, the rules of engagement, which is currently being hotly debated all over social media at the moment? But I want to make sure it's interesting to you. To you, my friends. Yes. Yes. Sean Connery. All right. You enjoy the Bible analyses? Yeah, thanks. I'm still... Okay. So, this is from Dr. Brian L. Cox. So, the... Dave Smith, of course, we talked about this a week or two ago, got into a debate with Douglas Murray. And Dave Smith is saying, you know, well, if you murder a bunch of kids, you're going to just create more enemies and all of that. So I get where he's coming from, obviously. But what I would say is, so he said, hey, Dave Smith, I'm your Huckleberry. Because Dave Smith's saying, I'm making a moral argument about violence, and other people are saying, I'm invoking legalities and doctrine. And agree with it or not, I think this is a very good explanation. He said, the reason actual experts like Spencer Gard keep, quote, invoking legalities and doctrine is because these are the rules that govern warfare. Just like domestic laws prohibiting murder, your term from previous posts on topic, and other categories of homicide, conduct of armed hostilities is governed by rules as well. There is a philosophical reason for having two general different sets of rules. And Dave Smith is saying, look, I mean, if you know, somebody does harm to you and then runs into a building, you can't just blow up the whole building with other people in it, right? And he's saying this is a moral argument. So he says, there is a philosophical reason for having two general different sets of rules. The reason involves the divergent context of domestic law enforcement and war. Your focus on the outcome, essentially people die in both, so what's the difference, fails to account for the divergent contexts. He said, in a domestic law enforcement setting, you can use force, but only if absolutely necessary and only the degree of force that is actually required. So if someone breaks into your house and you feel like your life is threatened, in most cases, you can kill them to protect yourself. But if they broke into your house while you weren't home and you encounter them on the sidewalk days later, you can no longer use force against them. Now your life isn't being threatened, so you need to report them to the police and let the law enforcement process play out. When the police arrest the suspects, they can only use the minimum force necessary as well. The reason minimum force, if any, is allowed by you as the victim or the police, as the agents of the state, is because you're all operating in an environment where the government has a general monopoly on the use of force. The government is supposed to function on behalf of the people while maintaining law and order. So using force to defend one's interests or vindicate one's rights is supposed to be the exception rather than the rule. Right. Again, we'll take the status considerations. Some of this would certainly apply in a free society. So he writes, in armed conflict, nothing I just wrote immediately above about the domestic law enforcement setting applies. Nothing, he says. Combatants have to use force to achieve the strategic aim of the elected officials who sent them to war. There is no monopoly on the use of force. The adversary can and will use force to achieve their strategic goals. In this context, any amount of force that is necessary to bring about the surrender of the adversary as rapidly as possible on terms most favorable to the victor is allowed philosophically and legally. You don't have to like it, and clearly you don't, but you also don't have a say in what international law involving armed conflict is. I mean, I think what he's saying is that the purpose of the police is the prevention of violence as much as possible, whereas the purpose of the army is the initiation and escalation of violence in order to win the war as quickly as possible, which you could argue would reduce violence in the long run anyway. Thank you, Isaac. freedomain.com/donate. So he writes, the philosophical difference between contexts explains why intent works differently in both. And the philosophical reason for this difference is a function of different concepts of necessity. He said, before I retired from U.S. military in 2018, I was subject to Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ. If I killed someone, when standard domestic law applied to me, I might be found guilty of murder in violation of Article 118 of UCMJ. If I killed someone in combat, Article 118 doesn't apply to that conduct. Is in standard domestic setting, presumption is that using lethal force isn't necessary. In combat, using force is necessary. The standard I'm held to there in combat is whether I intentionally, knowingly, and on purpose directed attack against civilian persons or objects. That standard is reflected in war crime sections of Rome Statute, which the U.S. hasn't ratified, but our use of force doctrine is substantially similar. And U.S. delegation played a central role in negotiating the text of the Rome Statute, but we haven't ratified due to jurisdictional concerns. So if someone knowingly directs attacks against civilian populations, she or he likely committed war crime, even if no civilian is killed or injured. The purpose of this law is to ensure any use of force is actually militarily necessary. He says, now folks like Spencer Gard and I take this law seriously because that's standard. That's the standard to which we're held if and when we do go to war. Many of us, John and I included, think about philosophical underpinnings of international law. But LOAC, law of, sorry, I missed that. I think he's just talking about international law. Sorry, LOAC is structured so military members don't have to reflect on theoretical foundations if they're not interested in doing so. LOAC and rules of engagement set limits on our conduct, and we're expected to comply with these requirements regardless of whether we agree philosophically or even if we've ever pondered theoretical concerns. LOAC rules set both legal and ethical standards, whether or not you like them or agree with them. Thankfully, we have an all-volunteer military, so unless there's a draft, you can live in blissful ignorance regarding differences between murder and war crimes. But if you do choose to remain blissfully ignorant, maybe think about not sharing your ignorant thoughts to a huge public audience. If you do, don't be surprised when someone like John or me challenges your ignorant assertions. And when we do, you should consider acknowledging you're out of your depth, taking the L, and just moving on with your life, and with a bit more knowledge than when you started. Very interesting. The law of armed combat. Thank you. Law of armed combat. Appreciate it. I was going to guess, but I might have missed it. I might have got it wrong. And so the big challenge, we see this, of course, throughout the history of combat. The big challenge is, what do you do? Like if you have two armies facing each other across the battlefield, you know, sort of trench warfare style or Napoleon style, and they clash together and there's no civilians around and so on. We accept and understand that this is war and there's no problems. I mean, obviously there are problems, but there's no foundational moral problems because there aren't civilians in the environment. So it's just soldiers fighting soldiers, and we may hate it, we may revile it, it may be slavery, draft, whatever, right? But we can understand that this is a army-on-army fight. The challenge, of course, is when combatants are no longer following the rules of war, right? So in the rules of war, and there's obviously a whole bunch of them, good treatment of POWs, you have to wear a uniform, you have to give your name, rank, and serial number, things like don't target civilians. I mean, obviously I'm no expert on these, but what do you do when people don't obey the generally accepted rules of war? What if they don't wear uniforms? What if they launch missiles from inside of hospitals? What if they capture children and use them as human shield? What do you do? That's the challenge. The challenge is not the rules of war when you're talking about clearly identified uniformed armies in a field with no civilians, right? That's not the issue. The issue is, what do you do with people who aren't following the rules of war? Yeah, sometimes they wear the uniforms of their opponents even. Yeah. What do you do? That's the foundational question. That's the essential question. And there seem to be two answers. One is, and we can sort of puzzle this out together philosophically if you're interested, but one is you say, if somebody is launching missiles from inside a hospital, you have to take out the hospital, because you're not taking out the hospital because of the hospital, you're taking out the hospital because they're using it as a launching pad for their missiles. Then, of course, the challenge is, as we've seen this happen countless times, they say, look, they hit a hospital. How terrible. Look how terrible they are. They hit a hospital. And then you get the negative publicity and propaganda and all of that, right? So who is responsible for bringing children into combat? I mean, clearly the people who are firing rockets from hospitals are putting the hospital at risk. Because you have to strike in a war, right? You have to strike where the missiles are coming from. And if they put it in a hospital, who's responsible for the hospital getting struck? Well, the people who put the rocket launchers in the hospital. If I'm wrong about that, do you disagree? Yes or no? I'm happy to be corrected on this, but the responsibility is, to me, on the people who are commandeering civilian buildings for military purposes. If a soldier grabs a child and is shooting at you, they grab a child and they're shooting at you, who is responsible for what happens to the child? I mean, these are very ugly things to deal with. And maybe I'm just a big old brutish Anglo-Saxon guy, but for me, the moral responsibility lies on those who are bringing civilians into the combat zone, or bringing the combat zone to civilians. And I'm not sure how that can in particular be avoided. I mean, one of the things I think is pretty important to living a moral life is that evil, it shouldn't work. It shouldn't win. It shouldn't, you know, kind of get what it wants in that way. You, I think, do your very best to have immorality not succeed in its goals, if that makes sense. Now, again, I mean, to reiterate, I'm obviously a prevention guy, peaceful parenting guy, and so on. But as far as just war theory goes, I mean, it's a brutal calculus. It's absolutely brutal calculus. But if you let enemy combatants grab children, and then you don't shoot, then they will just grab more and more children. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, they're going to strap a whole bunch of kids to themselves and go into combat. James says, isn't the same principle at play when there's a guy who robs a convenience store and the clerk fires a shotgun but hits a bystander, is that the responsibility falls upon the thief? Yeah, because he initiated the sequence which led to the bystander being shot. So, I mean, the other thing too, of course, is that in peacetime, in a state, or in a free society, or you know, in a state that's not currently in a geographical region, not currently at war, you have time. You have time. If you have a guy with hostages in a bank in a time of peace, you have time. He's not calling for airstrikes. He's not calling for backup. You have time. Maybe you can wait him out. Maybe you can starve him out. You can talk him out. You can, whatever. There's a bunch of different options. You don't have really the luxury of quarantining, isolation, and time in a state of war. In a state of war. So time is of the essence. A long theological point made short. Satan rules this world. Feels that way sometimes, for sure. Steph is not wrong. They will just tie kids to their tanks, the ultimate armor. There are cases where one side will bomb civilians on their own side, point fingers at their opponents just to make the opponents look bad. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, that's one of the false flags that got the invasion of Poland going. September 1939, they shot up and threw some bodies around a German radio station, if I remember rightly, something like that. False flags are very, very common, tragically common. I mean, in general, I think, in general, get it? But I think in general, what you want to do is get the war done as quickly as possible. And have as minimally damaged a civilian population as possible. Did you know all 27 of Uranus' moons are named after William Shakespeare and Alexander Pope characters? I did not know that. I did not know that. The false flag that Assad gassed his own people. Not only do I remember that, I remember reporting on that back in the day. And you see what's happened to Christians after that, right? Somebody says, in World War II, the Japanese would purposefully target medics and would hide military assets under Red Cross symbols. Banzai charges, fake surrenders, followed by grenade attacks. The barbarity of the Japanese was countered with the barbarity of the Marines. Precision munitions are a luxury people will have to get used to unrestricted warfare once again. Yeah. I mean, the brutal sacrifices and compromises that war requires is an easy thing to lecture and bloviate upon when you're not trying to win a war. It is. I mean, I am thankful every day that I'm not in a situation where I've had to make those kinds of choices with weaponry. So, the deaths of children in war is very sad, very terrible, terrible, terrible. And of course, the purpose is to not start the war, or if the war is underway, to conclude it as decisively and quickly as possible and return to a state of peace. All right. Any other questions, comments? Issues, challenges? to wait a long time for me. All right. This is interesting from Katie Faust. She wrote, "Wherever Christians went, children's lives got better. They fought abuse, ended deadly customs, and transformed entire cultures to protect the vulnerable. Amy Carmichael rescued thousands of girls from temple prostitution in India. She founded the Donavar Fellowship, a safe home and school that gave these children dignity, education, and a future. Mary Slessor saved hundreds of twins in Nigeria from being killed due to tribal superstition. She adopted many, raised them as her own, and helped change local attitudes towards children and women. Gladys Aylward led 100-plus orphans across war-torn China to safety during the Japanese invasion. She opened orphanages, taught children, and became a beloved figure in her adopted home. George Muller cared for over 10,000 orphans in 19th-century England. He provided housing, food, and education, all by faith, never asking for donations. Lillian Trasher, the mother of the Nile, founded the first orphanage in Egypt. She cared for thousands of abandoned children over 50 years, offering love, education, and stability in a chaotic world. William Carey fought child sacrifice, female infanticide, and child marriage in India. His Christian convictions drove social reform and helped spark legal protections for children. Christian missionaries in China helped end foot binding." The foot binding is unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And I remember reading a woman's report on foot binding. It said they would curl the toes under the foot for some bizarre sexual fetish for the Chinese men. Oh, it was just repulsive. Anyway, it just ended like that. Like, one generation was there, next generation wasn't. So Christian missionaries in China helped end foot binding. They refused to admit bound feet girls to schools and launched the Natural Foot Society, which led to cultural change and eventual legal bans. David Livingstone exposed the brutal Arab slave trade in East Africa, freed captives, and challenged slave traders directly. His reports shocked Britain, fueling abolitionistic action and efforts to replace slavery with trade and gospel-driven reform. Horace Mann, inspired by Christian ideals, helped build America's public school system. Christians like Lord Shaftesbury and Dr. Bernardo led campaigns to end child labor in Victorian England, founding home schools and pushing for laws to protect street kids from exploitation. And anyway, goes on and on. But credit where credit is due, in my opinion. How is your ESF? All better? I would say mostly. Yeah, it's mostly better. I got hit with a nasty ear virus, and for a while there, like a month or whatever, I could hear my voice in my own ear. It's mostly better. It's getting better. It's like 3 months for these things to get better. It's crazy. The connection between, so Kyra says, the connection between bettering the lives of children and Christianity is detailed extensively in The Rise and Fall of Childhood. Lloyd Demos talks about foot binding in his essay, The Universality of Incest. Yeah. The late, great Lloyd Demos. The Origins of War and Child Abuse definitely is worth listening to. All right, look at that. We actually went over an hour this time. I'm just going to see if I have anything else that's yearning burning to talk of. Ayn Rand's Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology is a great book. Recommend. All right. Yeah, if Texas authorities have the video of the Austin Metcalf and Carmelo Anthony confrontation, oof, I say. It's nothing that anybody wants to see, but I suppose people will have to see it, right? I do not know what the Cretilian problem is. America's original schools were on private Christian Diamond Time. Government got their fat foot in the door, kicked God out, and now demand donations even when indoctrinating with offensive anti-American ideas. Thanks for a great stream. Going to donate on free domain. Thank you very much. freedomain.com/donate. Harvard founding motto, Veritas Christo et Ecclesiae, meaning truth for Christ and the church. It's funny to think that nobody knows how Latin is pronounced, right? Nobody knows. Nobody knows how Latin is pronounced because, of course, there's no audio, right? Don't remember his name, but there was a Christian Englishman who petitioned the British government for years to ban the practice of wife burning in India. After years of lobbying, the British government finally banned it. I mean, this is the white man's burden, right? It was the idea that we happen to, in the sort of Christian West, come across some really good morals and principles and systems of government and economics, and we were going to go and bring that to the world. Like, you can just go and transplant Dorset to Mumbai. That was a great delusion. I mean, a very powerful delusion, but a false thing. All right. Let me see if you have any last questions, comments. Last questions. Second round of a job interview tomorrow. Appreciate that. Good luck with your job interview. Just remember to remember it's an exchange of value, that you're there to get value as well and not just begging for a job. A little tip more if all goes well. Thanks for the stream, Steph. I appreciate that. Thank you guys for dropping by tonight. A real deep and humble pleasure to have this chat with you. And we do know how Latin was pronounced. We know indirectly through misspellings of texts of the time. Oh, so people tried to spell it phonetically. How do you think the economy is going? There's no economy. It's a bubble. It's all a bubble. It's all a bubble. It's all the money printing and debt. And, I mean, obviously some real things, but that's very much occluded by the giant farty waste gas of inflated currency. So I'm a hard money guy. You know, like that guy who said, you know, my girlfriend says, like, I'm the worst she's ever had in bed. I'm like, there's no way you can come to that conclusion in like 23 seconds. Crazy. All right. Have a wonderful evening, everybody. Thank you so much for dropping by tonight. Lots of love. We will talk to you on Friday. And freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. And I appreciate your time here tonight.